Slash number 12663, real one.
Colonel Watchmore, real one. Could we start off, please, by your telling me where you were born and what your father did for a living?
I was born in Torquay in 1931 and moved from there to Farnborough in Hampshire in 1938, where my father took up an appointment in the Royal Aircraft Establishment.
Did you go to school in Farnborough?
Yes. Both primary and secondary school in the Farnborough Grammar School.
How old were you when you left?
17 and a half.
What did you do when you left?
I went to the Admiralty as a civil servant, pending the inevitable arrival of the date when I should join for national service.
How did you view the prospect of going in for the national service?
Oh, I looked forward to it enormously. I think being brought up as a schoolboy during the Second World War and hearing about all the activities and victories of the Allied forces and hearing the what amounted to propaganda during the time about our cause and realising that that cause, particularly after the war, realising that cause was good against evil, I was very keen indeed to join the army. Indeed, I wanted to become a regular, but my parents were not very keen on that idea.
Can you tell me about the process of going into the National Service?
Yes, it involved a medical examination two or three months before the actual call-up, and I recall lines of white naked young men waiting to be seen by a whole variety of doctors in Aldershot, but eventually one received papers to join at a particular place. I had applied to join the King's Royal Rifle Corps in Winchester, which was near Farnborough and seemed relatively simple. I was in fact called up to the Highland Light Infantry and went to Fort George in Scotland.
What happened to you there?
Well, they had a very good system of selection and training there. I enjoyed the training, but early on in the first week or two I saw a man called the personnel selection officer who asked me various questions, and I made it clear to him that though I had no antipathy towards the Scots in general, I did really want to be in a regiment further south. I didn't particularly want to join a Scottish regiment, in other words. And it worked. In 2 weeks he had me transferred to the King's Royal Rifle Corps at Bushfield Camp in Winchester.
What did you think of the training that you received?
In Fort George, excellent. Very hard landscape in which to do it, and the barracks were dreadful. In Winchester, I don't think the training could have been better. First, because they knew what they were doing. The King's Royal Rifle Corps was an excellent regiment. And second, because quite soon after I arrived there, a draft of new recruits came in, most of them having just come down from Oxford. And we were all put together in a platoon for training as potential officers. So the company was congenial, the training was excellent, the food was good, the barracks were pleasant, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Can you be more specific in what way militarily the quality of the training was so high?
Well, we not only engaged in the obvious basic training, and perhaps it's not so obvious, but the 60th have a peculiar kind of drill, for one thing, which was enjoyable to do. But the standard of instruction and the facilities for carrying it through, such as the ranges, the local countryside for night exercises, even the gymnasia, were all of a very high standard, and the instructors themselves quite clearly enjoyed what they were doing.
Now, how did you get out of Korea?
Well, I went from Bushfield to Chester, the officer cadet school there, Eaton Hall. I was commissioned from there into the Royal Hampshires, was when I was still only 18, so I wasn't allowed to go overseas. So I was posted for a few weeks to the Royal Berkshire Regiment, who had just come back from overseas, and then to the Royal Hampshires at Bulford, who were doing a training establishment job there. And when the Korean War broke out and reinforcements were called for, I was selected as the only officer from the Royal Hampshires at that time to go as a reinforcement to Korea. So I was posted off in June, July, I think it was, of 1950 to the J reinforcement unit, JRHU they call it, at Otley in Yorkshire. Had a bit of embarkation leave, was given a platoon of soldiers to look after, was transported by train down to Southampton, joined the troop ship, the Empire Fowey, and sailed for Korea, arriving in sailed for Japan actually, and arrived there in November 1950.
What politically was your attitude towards the Korean War, if any?
I had no political opinion about it at all. I was perhaps too young to worry about politics, too involved in the military sausage machine to have much opinion about it or beyond it, and was perfectly content to do as I was required.
So it was just a purely professional approach?
Well, professional, inevitable approach, if you like. But I really quite looked forward to it. I mean, it was really a great adventure, without a doubt.
Whereabouts did you travel from Japan from?
We went to a camp in Kure in Japan, not all that far from Hiroshima. And I spent from November till February 1951 in that camp, or up at a battle camp at Haramura, up in the hills. And it was a life of continuous training, really. Eventually, reinforcements were required in Korea, and I was sent on a tank landing ship to Busan, and by air, rail, and rode up the Korean Peninsula until I joined the battalion, which at that time was just south of Seoul.
Whilst you were in Japan, what kind of briefing did they give you about what to expect and what to do once you got to Korea?
Well, from the point of view of training for fighting, the battle school, which I went to twice, was excellent from the point of view of physical fitness. You had to march 20 miles there and 20 miles back, I recall. Tactics, shooting, did lots and lots of shooting of all sorts of weapons, and general confidence building. It was excellent in terms of explaining many political background to the Korean War. There was none.
But did they say anything about the military caliber of the enemy you were expected to meet?
No. Virtually no briefings as such, no lectures, no intelligence, I suppose, about the enemy was made in my time in Korea, in Japan rather.
Or about how to behave in the foreign country as regards looking after yourself and so on?
No. Mind you, the training that one was doing inculcated that into one anyway, I suppose. But no, there was no indoctrination, no briefings of those of that kind.
Which month do you think that you went across to Busan?
February 1951.
And what were your first impressions when you got there?
Standing off Busan, waiting to dock, there was a deadly stench. And looking at the place, it seemed to be a town of corrugated iron gone red rusty. In Busan, they didn't know we were coming. We had to make our own way to the airfield and hitch a ride on a transport plane, which was driven by an American pilot who appeared to me to be a schoolboy, up to Taegu, where we were met by a British transport officer and guided onto a railway train, which took us a bit further, and then we hitched a ride on trucks, staying overnight, I remember, at a Rimi unit who welcomed us with open arms, and then on to the battalion rear echelon, and then up to battalion headquarters.
What impression did Korean civilians make on you as you passed through?
Well, south in Busan, where, after all, there had been battles only a few weeks previously, there were many refugees, battered and poor-looking people, all in their native costumes, and all with a downcast air. Further up the line, it didn't much improve. The people were stolid. They weren't welcoming. They weren't. They didn't show any antipathy. They were just existing, I think, and recovering from the experiences that they had recently been through.
Did you expect to go straight into the front line?
I expected to join the battalion and go wherever it went. At the time I joined it, we were actually out of the line. And I can remember that there were just a few remnants of snow still on the ground. I had missed the dreadful winter conditions that the men of the battalion had experienced up north, in North Korea. And the spring was just beginning. And so I was able to join a platoon out of the line and get to know the men and adjust to the living in what was a Korean village. And I recall that I created a sensation by changing into pajamas the first couple of nights. But I soon gave that up.
What did the rest wear?
Oh, we wore vest and pants, as I did for the rest of the time.
And what was your platoon?
It was number 11 platoon in D Company, commanded by a Major Lackery Wood, and there were three other platoons. Two other platoons, beg your pardon, three in total.
Lackery, I think, is the Hindustani for Wood.
That's correct, yes. Yes, he was a Burma veteran.
Then what happened to you?
Well, but the battalion moved from place to place. And finally, in early April, I moved up to positions just south of the Imjin River, near the 38th parallel in Korea, where the entire 29th Brigade was deployed in a what I can only describe as a temporary position. It wasn't a fully prepared defensive position. There were very little wire, only a few flares, tripwire flares, and of course we dug slip trenches. But it was the kind of position from which one would appear that one was ready to move off again to advance further north. Indeed, from it we did one battalion strength patrol involving a night river crossing across the Imjin and penetrating 10 to 15 miles beyond it, searching for the enemy. We found none. We found one or two wretched Koreans. I vividly recall a few of them hoisting high a banner saying in English, "Welcome, United Nations soldiers." But even then, I wondered whether they had another one in their huts, which they could hoist when the Chinese came down, saying, "Welcome, communist Chinese soldiers." They were in a wretched position. They couldn't win. But we found no Chinese, and we withdrew back across the river to our positions.
And then?
In mid-April, well, on the 22nd of April, which was, I think, a Saturday, we received information in the morning that Chinese in numbers had been sighted moving south towards the Imjin. And that gave us sufficient time to prepare for what was clearly likely to be a battle. So we got up a bit more ammunition, and we oiled our weapons and looked to them and prepared ourselves to fight. And then that night, at about 11 o'clock, I suppose, in the evening, with a very full and bright moon, one could see a long way, there was firing down at the southern end of a ford across the Imjin, immediately in front of us. And I learned later that the battalion commander had sent forward a patrol to mark that ford, and that they were the first people, therefore, actually to meet the Chinese who were wading across the river. It was very shallow at that point, at this time of year, and there were no bridges then. But the Chinese waded across there and at one or two other points close by, and the firing we heard at 11 o'clock was our patrol shooting up the first leading elements of the Chinese, and that was then joined with artillery fire onto the same area, and that went on for for 2 or 3 hours perhaps, until the patrol was withdrawn.
How did you feel like being in firing for the first time?
It was a strange experience, really. One could see occasional tracer bullets flying around, and they were very, very beautiful and going very slowly somehow through the night air. They weren't coming particularly near us, and they clearly weren't aimed at us. So hearing it was not particularly worrying, but I think one realised that it was going to come our way quite quickly, as indeed it did. There was a pause, so to speak, of maybe half an hour, maybe an hour, once the patrol had withdrawn, And then serious firing began to occur on a hill which was occupied by A Company of the Gloucesters, to the left of where our position was. And that signalled the Chinese assault on that company. And then one began to hear noises on the long, long slopes of hills below us, and it was quite clear the Chinese were moving up those. And then they began to blow bugles. And that was a bit nerve-wracking, because the bugles got closer and closer. They were the Chinese system of guiding their forces on in the right direction, correct direction. So eventually the noises were not only bugles but clearly men rustling through the bushes, and I ordered the 1st Gloucester's battalion mortar fire. I happened to have a mortar fire controller in my trench with me, a little man, a corporal, with a radio straight back to the mortar platoon, who had a prearranged fire plan to fire in support of D Company. And when I thought the enemy was close enough, I ordered the corporal to get his men to fire, which they did, and their 2 bombs fell exactly on my platoon. 2 men were wounded, not very seriously, but I was angry, and the mortar fire controller was absolutely furious because his own side had shot at him. And he did the necessary on his radio to get them to increase their range, and then they fired 1 or 2 more bombs at the enemy, but it didn't really stop them. And then the Chinese finally got to us, and they assaulted us in waves of infantry, and it was still dark, the moon was still high, but insufficient really to get a bearing, a good bearing on individual targets. So the front 2 sections of my platoon fired everything they had really at the advancing enemy, and at about just after first light, just as dawn was breaking, the Chinese actually captured the front trenches of my platoon by firing at them and throwing grenades, and they throwing grenades back. We had quite a fight for, I suppose, about half an hour.
Can you describe any incidents that stick out in your mind as the Chinese closed with your position?
Yes. I can recall a Chinese machine gun seen only by the flashes of its muzzle firing directly at us, and the soldier using the 2-inch mortar in my platoon firing back, and as far as I could estimate in the darkness, hitting it exactly despite the darkness. And I was able to shout congratulations to him before a few minutes later he was hit and was withdrawn. I can recall the corporal in charge of the forward section shouting for more ammunition, which we tried to throw to him, but the fire was so intense it was difficult to do so. I can recall a Chinese machine gun out on our right flank, which was deadly accurate, and as the light came up, shot in the head the batman, my batman, who was firing in the same trench that I was, next to me.
So it was enfilading the opposition, was it?
Yes, it was. And that was a feature, I think, one of the features anyway, that I would recall about the Chinese, their independent machine gun teams, which, when they came across opposition, went round to the flanks and were deadly accurate and clearly acting independently, helped pin down the defensive fire. I can recall firing myself a Sten gun, which a notorious fault in Sten guns eventually jammed, and I used the dead batman's rifle until there was no more ammunition, and then I used my pistol because they were within pistol range, and when I ran out of ammunition I used a Vary gun, very light, didn't hit anything, but I think they frightened them.
Did you have targets that you could see?
Oh yes. As I say, the Chinese overwhelmed the front section, and on one occasion when I looked up, there were three of them in what had been one of our pit trenches, and he saw me and I saw him, and he threw a grenade at me, which fortunately landed short, and I ducked and didn't have any effect. And I threw one back at him, and it did have an effect. And eventually they retired.
What effect did it have?
It killed them. Well, at least they didn't fire again. But by this time, the front two sections were all crying that they were pretty well out of ammunition. And I had none left, and we had none in reserve. And having lost contact with the company headquarters, I did have a telephone line, but that had been cut. I had to decide what to do, and I decided that without ammunition we couldn't really hold the place. And so I ordered the remnants to retire. And this we did, and it was quite as dangerous to do that against our own fire as against the enemy, because just behind my platoon position on a knoll was a section of Gloucester's medium machine guns, set there to in fact fire across it to help A company. But they spent quite a lot of their time firing over open sights, supporting me. And when we retired, we had to retire up the hill towards them. And they were two guns, and they were firing on either side of us. And as we reached them, one of the guns was hit and became useless. And I then reported to the company commander, who in fact was not the Major Wood I've mentioned before. He happened to go on leave to Japan just before the battle,